gonna spend the rest of my life telling this story, ain't I?
We know the dangers. This is one person using it.
I'm gonna have some muzzle.
Alright, I'm good.
Here we go.
Hello, and welcome to this, the first episode of Season 2 of At the Meadow. I'm your host, Joseph Carver. At the Meadow is where we gather to discuss all things innovation and creativity in independent schools. We're starting Season 2 with a very special guest, Dr. Michelle Borba, the author of Unselfie, Why Empathetic Kids Succeed in Our All About Me World, and Thrivers. This past summer, the faculty of the Meadow School read Thrivers. And this week, Dr. Borba will be joining us on campus to speak to our faculty about the messages behind the book and how we can help our students to succeed in thriving. We expect parents wouldn't be able to attend a session like this so early in the school year, so we decided to sit down and have a conversation with Dr. Borba to share with our audience so they too could benefit from the wisdom of an international expert on parenting and teaching. I hope that you enjoy this episode of At the Meadow.
At the Meadow, the podcast we started just about a year or so ago, we have always said since the very first episode that all of our guests are, we think of them as superheroes from different walks of life. So we've had novelists on, we've had musicians, we've had thought leaders in education like yourself, but different types of superheroes from different walks of life. And so we always start the way you start with every superhero story, which is an origin story. So I wonder if you could just walk us through how you got from starting your career in brief to being, you know, spending your time traveling the country, making schools better.
Oh, my career has just never been a goal set. It's been, the phone rang, I answered it. If it sounded interesting, I went there. And as a result, my life changed. I started with severe learning disabled children way back when in Northern California. And I always wondered why some kids struggled and others were thriving. 2 years later, I was working with affluent kids in another district. And I began to see that regardless of where I went, kids had the same needs. From there, it became fascinating. I started to work on social emotional learning for my kids in those classroom settings when that didn't exist. Mm-hmm. And I had so many people coming and observing the classroom. A couple of people said, you should write a book. I thought, how absurd is this? So I actually did, to keep my incredible aide, who was so, so loving and supportive, quiet. I said, okay, I'm going to write a book, but I'm going to send it to 10 publishers. Nobody's going to want it. I wrote the whole thing on graph paper, printed it out, sent 10 chapters and got the 8 acceptances. There it went. I went, wow, this is a hot new topic. From that, it came down to speaking engagements. And my career took off because what I began to do is get a little bit deeper in life in terms of getting my doctorate in educational counseling and psychology. But I think the most important thing, Joe, that changed my life was actually working in schools across the world, from Rwanda to Cambodia to the killing fields to the most extraordinary affluent schools in the United States of America. And I saw something was changing in kids everywhere, and we needed to reboot our thinking patterns.
It's interesting that you mentioned your pivot to doing social emotional learning before it sort of had a name. It just this morning, I was sort of thinking about that. It was a question I wanted to ask you that, you know, it's obviously a term that's been, you know, in some ways hijacked and become a politicized term. Yes. But I've heard parents even say, you know, we don't look to schools for social emotional learning. But when I try to envision my life in schools, I feel like all of my conflict resolution skills, all of my learning to work through difference, all of my prizing relationships, all of that happened at school. I mean, it's 40 hours a week for our 7 and 8 year olds, right? And if we're not doing that, so what are your thoughts about how we get back to a place where parents aren't as skeptical about the term social emotional learning and back to providing kids the sort of like character foundation that schools traditionally have?
I think the first thing is we need to help parents realize that character, as well as social and emotional learning, is not fluff. It's real, it's transformational. And I think the way to go is actually start at the top and work back. What really draws them in is helping them realize that the top employability factors now, when your child finally leaves that college of your dreams, we're finding that many of them are not future ready. And when we look at what Harvard Business Review, the World Economic Summit, what are they saying that kids need more than anything else are people skills. And if they don't have those people skills and deeper learning, what'll happen is they're not world ready. 63% of the kids right now in our classrooms will not have the jobs that are right now available for them when they finally leave high school and college. The world is so accelerated that I think the first thing is for parents to realize this is going to help your child be world ready. The second thing is when they start to recognize mental health is not just something that is a fluff concept. It is a national epidemic. And if we don't help all of our children be ready for that, we got another issue. And that's back to Harvard again. The number one time our kids are most likely to drop out of school is not before high school. It's first semester, end of first semester of college, when all of the, actually why I wrote Thrivers, is I was seeing a trend of 2,500 mental health counselors saying there's something going on in our colleges. They get their first B plus and they're devastated. They don't know how to rebound. Our kids are not world ready, but they're not also resilient for just freshman year in college. And those begin to help parents see we got to do something more. We got to make them help our kids be able to realize that resilience is not something that's just going to help them then, but it's going to help them now. It's going to help them in a classroom, get those grades up, be the best thinker they can be, but also be their personal best to keep their mental health alive and well.
It's interesting that's your focus, because last year, both on the podcast, last season on the podcast, and then last year academically, we had Dr. Trish George, who's a professor at USC, came and spoke. She's actually an alum of the Meadows School, and she came and spoke. And her topic was the science of happiness. Mm. And it was a lot about saying, you know, we can't think of happy as this sort of just, you know, as you said, fluff thing. And the response from parents was incredible. Parents want their children to be happy. They want us to make an effort to teach them how to be happy. But there's some connective tissue between that social emotional learning piece and happiness that they need to understand exists. Oh,
I love that concept, because I think in all fairness to us as parents, I've got three boys, but we all have kids, but we got hit with the self-esteem bandwagon that if we just praise our kids to death and we give them trophies and we just tell them you're going to be the best you can be and you can be anything you want to be, it doesn't help. In fact, what we now know is Ohio State says it raises the narcissistic, a self-absorbed kid who's more stressed. What they need is the practical protective buffer factors that help give them, I think, agency. And when we're looking at children who are actually happier, it's kids who say, I got this, I can control my own life. And that's why I think the bottom line to this is thrivers are made, not born. We've just got to reboot our parenting and our educational practices, not to get rid of everything, but just say, who's this kid right now in my classroom? Who's this child I'm raising in this generation? And what does that child need in order to thrive? And it's going to be different than how we were raised. And even 10, 20 years ago, the world is changing. So too must our own perspectives and our own agendas.
So we're going to talk about Thrivers in a minute. And I'm so excited. This is an opportunity to mention that you'll be joining us here at the Meadows School during our orientation week to speak to our faculty and staff. And we're thrilled that you're coming. Yeah, I think that one of the things that's particularly timely about the publication of Thrivers is coming out of the last 2 years. And so I'd like, as a starting point, if we could, for you to talk a little bit about the importance of both acknowledging the sort of epidemic of anxiety and the development of the tools that are necessary. Like, and specifically, because I feel like this is where we often get lost, specifically about how critical that is to success. Because I think that sometimes we think of these things as running on parallel tracks to like rigor or success, but they're not. They're literally conditions that are necessary. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about, especially as where we are, you know, 2 years into this, you know, the pandemic and the stoppage of school in person and all of that. What are what anxiety looks like for students right now and the significance it has addressing that is to them thriving in the future.
Oh, there's so many layers to this, and it's so critical. Maybe there is a moment in time when we can sit and look at this pandemic and say, maybe there's one little point to it that was the aha moment for us all. And that is that the world is uncertain, and it is becoming more uncertain. And when uncertainty builds and unpredictably builds, what happens is anxiety builds. If we don't feel like we've got coping strategies or a way to at least, you can't change the world, but at least deal with it. The first thing I think we've done is try to sanitize our kids and remove all stress from them. And that's a huge mistake because you rob your child of resilience. What they need to know, what we need to know is we can handle it. We got to handle it in what Navy SEALs told me is in little chunks. We just chunk our fear. We chunk the worry. We don't try to get through the whole battle. We try to get through the first 10 minutes, then the next 10 minutes, then the next 10 minutes. And one SEAL told me, if you can tell a kid that, you got this, but don't try to take the whole thing on. Try to chunk it. Try to also be aware of what your stress signs are. They're different for every kid. But maybe the cool thing right now is for all of us to tune into our children a little more. We got the summer. Now is the time to say, how does our kid, each one of our kids is different, handle stress? How about our parenting partners? How about ourselves? If we know that, it's the first step to be able to know how do you handle stress. For instance, some kids, I watch them in classrooms. You can see little guys, they start to move their feet back and forth. I see some kids, girls tell me that their palms get sweaty and they start going back and forth on their knees. Not all girls, but some of them. I've seen some kids start to bite their tongue or grind their teeth. I've seen some kids rock. I see some kids, you literally can see their heart start to palpitate or their breathing get a little more up and down and up and down. Those are actually wonderful signs to a child because you can't control stress unless you know it's coming. Mm-hmm. What we're doing is, I think, number one, as all of us, how this impacts the adult population as well as the kids, is you notice we're all in burnout mode. And one of the things that we're now realizing is that why we're in burnout is that many of us are letting the stress discontinue without ever letting it figure out how to reduce it a little bit or take it down a notch like a pressure cooker. How do you reduce the pressure? It's different for every child. It's different for every adult. So step one is let's help our kids learn to recognize their stress and don't give them time out when they've got it. But instead, I noticed something about you. I noticed that right before the time test or right on Wednesday morning when you go to that practice or right around 3 o'clock in the afternoon, you're not stressed 24/7. When's the trigger and when's the time? That's when I'm starting to see you get a little more agitated, or that's when you get a little more irritable, or that's when you start to withdraw, or that's when you start to cry. Let's figure that out. What's going on at that time? Well, maybe they missed the nap, or maybe they didn't get the food supplement, or maybe they're scared to death of that coach. You can always, as a parent, figure out what to do about it by at least figuring out what the trigger is. The next thing is, so now you give them coping strategies. And the best thing, I started interviewing kids. I'm telling you, if you want a solution to a problem, ask a kid. They always have the best things. Had a group of very affluent kids from Greensboro, private academy, high school kids told me, this is what they need. We're the most stressed out generation on record, you know. I said, okay, what do you need? He said, well, somebody needs to give us a repertoire. That was the key word. Repertoire of things we can do to reduce stress. And one kid said, it's got to be a repertoire. You know, mindfulness works for some kids. Meditation works for another. You know, exercise works for another. Give us a repertoire. Let us choose what works for us. And then one other kid, yeah, but then we got to practice because you don't learn it in a health unit. You got to keep practicing the same thing over and over again until you can use it without the parent. We can do it anywhere and anytime. And that's really what I've just told you, the four steps of stress management. I think it's critical.
It's interesting because, you know, the pandemic did a lot. It's done a lot of things in education, obviously. We've all been changed by it. But one of the things it did is it brought parents into the classroom, right? Because all of a sudden, my son was doing his math homework at our table. And I'd obviously been able to be a part of that his whole life, my wife as well, because we're both in education. But now it was everyone was doing it. And I think there's a distinction that sometimes, especially in stress management, that gets lost. The idea is not, and I think this is what you're saying, the idea is not to eliminate stress from our children's lives, but the idea is also not to send them out to sea with stress without an oar. There's a middle where we acknowledge that stress exists and we provide them with the resources to navigate. And that's both a school and a parent's job. We have to be, you know, we all have to work together to provide those. And I sometimes feel like there is a sense that you either are trying too hard to wrap children in warm blankets and not let them experience the world so that you can protect them, or we just wash our hands of it and say, this is how the generation before did it. That's how you get resilience. But that's not how we get resilience, right? We get resilience because somebody takes the time to say, here are tools, and we find that tool that's the right tool for the job. And that's what that we learn from. I mean, is that a fair, do you think?
I think it's huge. And I love that. Don't send them out to sea without an oar. You should put that on a bumper sticker. That's that is exactly what we need to do. But let's go back to why some of us are still caught into the old mentality of just send them out to sea. They'll figure it out on their own. The greatest new thing probably in the last 10, 20 years is the resilience, science of resilience, where the most extraordinary scientists have been trying to figure out why some kids struggle and others thrive. What they've actually looked at is children who have overcome extreme adversity. We're not talking about a little pandemic or not going to a prom. We're talking about homelessness, sexual abuse, schizophrenic parents, extreme adversity. Emmy Werner is my goldmine on that one, which she did for 40 years, has been studying and tracking the same 700 children in extreme adversity. She was blown away. This is University of California, Davis. What did she find out? By the end of just during adolescence, she found that for some reason, many of them were bouncing back. They were making it, they were rebounding. She said, is it DNA? Is it something out of a certain zip code? Is it a race, a culture, what their religion? No. The single most important thing is they all had protective buffers. They had learned protective ways that when the stress built, they could go to doing that strategy to reduce their stress. Now, when you look at that and you go, oh my gosh, who's got time to hire another tutor or buy another program for that? No, Emmy Werner also said the most amazing thing is they were doing ordinary things like a hobby. Like knitting for one kid, like music for another, like a prayer for Ruby Bridges used prayer. It's amazing on simple, what Ann Matston, another researcher, says, ordinary things can make extraordinary differences on a kid's life in terms of being the protective buffer. But the key is they've learned what works for them. They keep using it over and over again. And if we teach those skills to our kids now, they actually reuse them the rest of their lives. So step one is resilience is teachable. Step two, it's never too late. Step three, it's not locked into DNA or your GPA. And four is it can be extremely ordinary things that can make extraordinary differences on kids' lives. So the takeaway here is, what's your skill that your child is using? What's the skill you're using? When that stress starts to build, oh, I see it. What are they going to do to reduce it so it doesn't keep going to anxiety, pessimism, or depression?
Right. So the backstory of how you and I became connected is that my wife was researching on behalf of our son, was lucky enough to be on a call with you, and immediately told me you have to hear her speak. Aww. And I got the book and I read the book overnight. I woke up in really early in the morning and read Thrivers from 2 to 7:30 or whatever it was in the morning. Read straight through it. Came in and told the head of school we need to buy this book for faculty and get it to them this summer. And obviously you and I worked really hard to get the copies, and that all happened. So, and I'm thrilled. I think Thrivers, one of the things that we did last year in my role of working with professional development and faculty is we found great people to address our faculty, but it was sometimes difficult to find speakers whose values really truly aligned with what our institutional values is. And what I loved about Thrivers was, Thrivers answers the sort of straw man argument that these things are at the expense of rigor. It says, no, this is rigor. this is what rigor really looks like. So, and I don't want to put words into your mouth about your book, but I would love it if you would just talk a little bit about the process of making the decision to write Thrivers and then what Thrivers is essentially about, to give a little bit of a preview for people who will be seeing you speak this fall.
Oh, well, thank you. But the process of writing it was driven again by kids. I begin to see a trend that I know every one of your educators has seen, and that is something's going on that we are seeing 1 in 5 American kids being diagnosed with a mental health disorder. That was prior to a pandemic. And I think it's really important to keep in mind that a crisis amplifies a pre-existing issue. That's why we're now looking at what the CDC says is unprecedented. 1 in 3 American kids are now suffering from a mental health disorder once the pandemic came. When I saw this, and that was really 10 years before the pandemic, I started looking at the science and it was confirming it. And then I started to ask myself the question of the why. And I began to see the big thing is we were so driven on test scores and GPA that, and not to say that we don't need test scores and GPA and strong academically smart kids. We need them. In fact, we're doing a fantastic job of graduating those kids. But it was the college group of all those counselors, Ivy League, that said, you got the smartest kids. These generation of children are amazing. But Bill Damon told me, Stanford, but they're also empty. We're seeing this trend of these kids coming in, IQs in the ozone layer, but they don't have a sense of purpose or they're driven in one direction. Then I saw Yale teachers telling me they're also less deep in their thinking. They're more risk adverse. They're afraid to think outside the box. Well, there goes their curiosity. So the key at that point was starting to interview the kids and interview. I'd already interviewed the scientists. I started interviewing educators. Are you seeing a trend? Because that I think is the real piece. You're the front line. You see kids and those teachers who had been in there 10 or 20 years, are you seeing a difference in your kids coming in? Once I knew that there was a difference, it was then combing the research going, if they're not thriving like they used to, then what can we do to help them? And that's when I bought tons of post-it notes because I would go through every bit of science there was and try to find out what's teachable that could stop this. And those were the only things that made the post-it notes. And then I'd put piles up based on here's what the science says, here's what's teachable that can boost resilience and peak performance. I didn't want one, it had to be both. It was nothing that's either or, because we still want kids who are gonna graduate smart, but we also want them to be able to graduate strong, mentally strong, so they can handle it. And it ended up being 7 strengths. And they were character strengths, but it was a process of elimination and then putting them in an order of which are the strengths that are most likely to boost heart, mind, and will. One little caveat, I also discovered it's a rare kid or adult that has all 7. But the more of these you have, the better. And it is not something you do sophomore year. You do it from age 3 on and you keep expanding this until they can finally leave and thrive without you. They're all teachable.
Is it fair to say then that in definition wise, and I'll let you define thriving, mm-hmm. but it sounds to me like the criteria was maximum effort, like work product, like producing smart kids combined with this notion of purpose. I mean, is that a fair explanation of
what thriving is? Yes, it was. It had to be the combination. That was my first thing, as I wanted the kids to continue to be smart like they are, but I wanted them to be able to be strong and handle life. That was resilience. That was performance and resilience. But then I was really worried about, oh my gosh, what are we going to do about the mental health, this crisis? Are any of these strengths also going to be ones that would curtail that crisis? Mm-hmm. So that added up. And then I came up with another one that high school teachers kept saying, but will they be prepared for life? So I started looking at what employers, the Gallup surveys were saying, a Harvard Business Review was saying, and it came up with, doggone it, the same ones of what they needed for resilience, mental health, and performance were also ones for future readiness. So that's how they came to be. That was my criterion. And then they also had to be teachable.
One of the things that jumped out at me when I first read Thrivers was, and this is a callback to something you referenced a little bit earlier, was the notion that this generation of students were not inspired. They're risk averse and didn't feel passionate about things. And my first reaction, to be honest, was, we've wrung that out of them by overworking them. But the more I think about it, and I'm interested, this is purely self-indulgent, but I'd like to get your thoughts on this. The more I think about it, the more I also think that the notion of everybody's a participant, everyone gets an award, could have had the exact same effect, right? I mean, is it fair to say that, you know, if no matter what level you perform at, everyone was treated the same, that has just as much of the possibility of wringing you out of enthusiasm and motivation?
Yes. Well, let's go to University of Chicago. When are you and me most delighted and happy and most passionate and refuse to give up? We're in a flow state. That is, we have discovered what we're good at and oh my gosh, we're driven by it and you can't stop us. So the first thing is, and that isn't always, it doesn't mean that you're going to stop helping your kid because he's struggling in math, give up helping him with the math. But what we do know, back to Bill Damon, back to the University of Chicago, first thing to quote you is that the average child in the United States of America who's highly gifted gives up their talent at age 13. They tracked kids who teachers said that is the most talented of the talented kids. They kept tracking them. And then they went, why are you quitting? Because I don't have time to devote to the talent. We've kind of put so many extra activities on them and they have to do this, this, this. They're studying like hours and hours and hours. My gosh, some of these kids told me how that they had to get the scholarship or they had to get into the college of their dreams. So they came home at 6 o'clock at night, had a little bit of a snack and kept working until midnight or 1 a.m. Then they got up at 6 a.m. or 5 a.m. And it was this cycle of, when I said, well, what's your hobby? They all looked at me dumbfounded. Who's got time for a hobby? The second thing that goes right to you is a scathing stat that said the average parent, oh, we're all going to die on this one. We spend 77% of the time trying to correct our kids and focusing in on their deficits as opposed to recognizing their strength. So what we've done is we've kind of curtailed our kid a little bit of the self-esteem is, that is coming from the outside in. You're great. You're wonderful. You're sweet. A kid who's got confidence knows it from the inside out. They recognize their own strength. And if once they find their asset or their talent, they're driven by it. And we can do that at a very early age. There's one other study that was, oh gosh, Lewis Terman study is absolutely amazing. Benjamin Bloom study. Benjamin Bloom studied Olympic athletes, the best and the best, neuroscientists, our best musicians, our best artists. What did they discover about how they were raised? The first teachers were always warm and positive. They acknowledged the child's assets. They didn't push the kid, but they made it fun. So piano was fun, if that's what looked like it was interesting. By the time the kid was 13, the kid was pushing the parent. Pulling the parent, pulling the teacher. They wanted to work harder because it was all coming from the inside out. So the first step of a thriver of those seven strengths is self-confidence. And that is asset building. Figure out who your child is, not what you want them to become. And you'll get the results of a mentally stronger kid because that's what's going to activate their grit.
So is it fair to say, I mean, maybe not, but as a parent, is the most common mistake I'm making that's stopping my children from being thrivers, is it that overcorrection, overemphasis? Like, I feel like I'm giving them the guardrails or the guide rails to life. Like, yo, you have to make sure you're doing this. Is that the most common mistake parents make when it comes to developing thrivers? And if it is, what else can we do to build that inside? That, you know, so that our kids are positioned to do that.
I love that. I love the question. Is it the most common? I'm not sure. Because what I did was recognize that each of these first seven strengths, just a footnote, each of these seven strengths was critical. What are the parenting styles that boost them? And then why is each one of these seven strengths plummeting in American kids?
Okay.
So what I began to see was there were certain styles that in all fairness, again, to us as parents, we were told was critical to do for our kids. One of the ones would be coddling them. So when you make a mistake, that's all right. I'm going to rescue them. And that immediately robs them of resilience. Carol Dweck 101 would say, watch out and step back because I love her work. That would be number six, you need perseverance. And she would say, stop always telling the kid they're wonderful, that everything's great, and stop always emphasizing what you get or that was 100%. Instead, break it down into, yeah, but yesterday you were here, sweetie, today you're here. And it's just one little step at a time makes the difference in a child. Then when they begin to see their own growth and their own effort. There's so many little things that what I discovered can make a major difference. And it's little switches that each one of them is going to need, we're going to be a little more intentional in our parenting. Our first step, you know, is we got to figure out why it matters, because otherwise we're not going to buy into it. Why the science says this is going to help our kid not only be happier, healthier, but also more successful. And that are, what are some day-to-day ways we can weave them in? And I always tell parents, please do me a favor. Don't take them all on, or don't go trying to read the whole book and do them all, or your kid will never let you read another book. Find one thing that's going to work for you. Write it down, pass it on to your parenting partner or the teacher or the grandparent, and start finding a couple of minutes every day to weave it in. It'll change your parenting and it'll change your child, and they'll be more likely to be resilient. Little intentional things make big differences.
So the, that's, I, as a parent, that's incredibly helpful. So now let's pivot to those who are daytime parents of 25 students at a time. So our teachers.
Yes.
What's a great starting point for a teacher who's listening to this and says, I want to make sure that I'm fueling students towards thriving. What could I do day one of school and change for my practice that would make a difference?
Well, number one is, this sounds so simplistic and simple, but realize you make a difference. I've talked to so many teachers that are like, do I really matter? Isn't resilience locked in? But look what he has to go home to. And if we can first just, I always start with a book club read. Read Educated, or read Boys in the Boat, or read The Glass Castle. Read something about a child who was in your classroom, and thank God for you, because if it hadn't been for you, this child wouldn't have made it. I think the first thing is we got to realize resilience is teachable. Second of all, don't go thinking you got to reinvent the wheel here. Look at what you already are doing in that classroom, because many of the things you are doing already support the model. I think we overlook that. We go, okay, I'm already doing growth mindset. Great. Then keep doing it. Maybe the next thing is, there's of everything in Thrivers, many people tell me the last appendix is the best. It's two pages of, here's the 7 strengths and here's the 21 skills. So maybe it's take a quiet moment and say, hey, of these, I'm going to yellow highlight which of these I'm already doing. And maybe the next thing is, of today's kids that are coming in my classroom, after what they've endured in the last 2 years, what do they need that maybe I am not supplying? And don't try to do the whole thing. Zero in on, I'd say, go to number 3, and that would be self-control, and teach stress management. And when you say, who's got time to do that? The best strategies I've ever seen, because the other thing I did when I was writing Thrivers was visit some of the most premier schools and classrooms I've seen in different demographics. And the best thing was quiet time. Every single day, the schools were doing 3 to 5 minutes of starting the day with, however it helps you. Is it slow, deep breathing, or is it meditation, or turning down the lights? And what they discovered in the Oakland, San Francisco schools, the test scores went up, attendance turned up, went up, suspensions went down, behavior went down, just because of one strategy, but it was became the teacher's routine. So I think that's the next thing is, find maybe this year, what's your daily 3-minute thing you're going to do every single day that works for you, that you think is going to help your kids. And it's, they're simple things that if you keep doing them, seem to make the biggest difference on our students' lives.
Well, I think, you know, we've spoken a number of times now. You do say over and over, these are simple things. I think that Thrivers, one of the things that's just amazing about Thrivers is it's intuitive. I read it and thought to myself, these are things I should be doing. It connected with practices that I tried to do, but it also gave really practical ways from both a parent and a teacher standpoint to make sure that we're giving kids what they need to thrive. And it's such an important book for teachers and parents to be reading. I do want to say that if you, that if you'd like to pick up a copy of Thrivers, you could probably find that at all the places that you buy your eBooks, also Amazon. You could also go to michelleborba.com. I'm sure that I understand there's a second printing underway. Is that right? Is there another?
Yeah, actually, there's a third printing.
Third printing, excuse me. Okay, that's amazing.
It's amazing.
Well, I'm grateful that we were able to get our copies before they all ran out for that brief period of time so that our faculty could read it. And I'm looking so forward to welcome you in August to the Meadow School. I do want to thank you for the time this morning. It's been an absolute pleasure, and I'm really, really excited about what you're going to bring to school to start our year.
I am so looking forward to being and visiting all of you in person. Thank you for the invitation.
Thank you, Dr. Borba.
That does it for this episode of At the Meadow. We'd like to thank Dr. Michelle Borba for joining us for the kickoff of Season 2. I'd encourage you to seek out Dr. Borba's work. You can find her books on Amazon or any location that you typically buy your books. They're well worth an investment in your time. We're very excited about what Season 2 has to offer of At the Meadow, and we hope that you'll subscribe and join us as we make this journey throughout this year. Again, thanks for listening and joining us at the Meadow.